Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how is the Trump presidency transforming the United States, and how might the resistance affect this? Joining us for the hour are four experts. Doug McAdam joins us. He is a professor of sociology at Stanford University and a former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. His 18 books include the prize-winning Freedom Summer and Deeply Divided, Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. Kenneth Roberts is a professor of comparative and Latin American politics at Cornell University. He's the author of Deepening Democracy, The Modern Left and Social Movements in Chile and Peru, and the co-author of The Resurgence of the Latin American Left. David Meyer is professor of political science and sociology at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America, and he's co-editor with Sidney Taro of The Resistance, The Dawn of the Anti-Trump Opposition Movement. David Karf is associate professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Move-On Effect: The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy and Analytic Activism, Digital Listening, and the New Political Strategy. They're all contributors to The Resistance, The Dawn of the Anti-Trump Opposition Movement, the book we're discussing today. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have the four of you on here. Such brilliance in one recording. I thought perhaps the best place to start, you've got this new book about the resistance. Maybe we should identify, it seems a little bit amorphous when we say the resistance. David Meyer, what are we talking about?
Well, the title is a little amorphous and the movement is a little amorphous. It's a collection of activists who have opposed Donald Trump and the Trump administration on some ground or another. And it includes people who really have no respect for American institutions at all and want to promote a revolution, but that's a tiny sliver of what's going on. And it includes people who have no problem with Trump's policies, but have a problem with his respect for law and his conduct in office, and basically everything in between. And it includes actions that range from street demonstrations and civil disobedience and vigorous protest to filing lawsuits to registering voters. So that's the resistance.
So it's not really necessarily so different from historic movements, except for that it sounds like they're from all different sides of political issues.
I think it's faster in mobilization in response to Donald Trump. And I think there's a sense of urgency and a grassroots involvement that took off much more quickly than other movements in the past. I think there are more new actors engaged in the political process than we've seen before.
Now, you in this chapter opening the book talked about some of the antecedents. You talked about Occupy, Black Lives Matter, immigrants' rights movements. How do you see these connected?
There's a dissatisfaction with the efficacy of institutional politics in the United States right now, and it takes place on both the right and the left. On the right, the most visible formation before the Trump campaign was the Tea Party. On the left, it's been a range of causes where even when you elect a president and even when you gain majorities in Congress, which people on the left did in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama, you don't feel like the government is delivering on your concerns. So it's a turn to movement politics. Now, the ones we've mentioned so far, immigrant rights. Immigrant rights has been on the docket since the middle 1980s, and Congress has been unable to act since that time, coming close a few times. Black Lives Matter, which is mostly directed at police violence at the local level. And again, demonstrating egregious conduct by police sometimes and unable to achieve policy victories. Occupy, pointing out effectively the problem of income and wealth inequality in the United States and political inequality, and really unable to convert and get policy change that addresses their concerns. All of that is simmering before Trump comes into office.
So maybe, first of all, just a thought about Occupy. I remember when that was happening, and my comment in one piece that I wrote was that they had failed partly because they stayed on the lawns of power instead of the halls of power, which is kind of what you're saying, that didn't go into the institutions where the power actually happens.
That's a very nice line.
You can use it, but you'll have to cite me. It sounds like the exception to some of this not having too much of a result is the immigrants' rights movement, which I think you said actually managed to stop a policy.
Well, it doesn't feel like a victory, though. So immigrant rights activists mobilized to stop harsher policies prior to Trump's administration against immigrants. A bill in Congress supported by a Republican congressman from Wisconsin, I think, James Sensenbrenner, and mobilization at the grassroots for rights stopped things from getting notably worse. But immigrant rights activists felt frustrated. And anti-immigrant activists felt frustrated, too, because they did all this demonstrating, all this organizing, a national caravan, and they couldn't get what they want.
So let's open it up for other comments on this, like understanding this. Well, all of you have done it from different perspectives. Doug McAdam, you did this historic perspective, including putting Trump into a historic perspective. How do you see this?
Obviously, Donald Trump is an unprecedented character, you know, rhetorically, behaviorally, et cetera, in terms of policies. But as I tried to argue in the chapter in the volume, you know, he is only the most extreme expression or product of a brand of racial politics that has been practiced, I would argue, ever more brazenly by the Republican Party. But its roots go back, I would argue, to the mid to late 1960s. So in that sense, you know, yes, Trump's election marks some sea change in American politics and American life, but we're so focused on him and his actions in office that we are in danger of losing the broader context in which he fits. I would also say that there's another way in which we need to keep him in context if we really want to do what we can to safeguard, protect, maybe preserve American democracy, is that there was a series of kind of illiberal institutional developments in this country, certainly stretching back 2-3 decades, that actually played a significant role in Trump's election. So since he's taken office and since he's taken various actions and we've learned more about the various scandals sort of swirling around his administration, there are all sorts of new threats of democracy that are sort of ever more visible. But his rise to power was aided by a series of illiberal institutional developments that we can't lose sight of. It simply is to say, if somehow he were removed from power tomorrow, that might, for many of us, be cause for celebration, but we would still have lots of institutional work to do to restore a full and functioning democracy. Right now, it feels very fragmented and fragile indeed.
So a couple of things on that. One is you keep mentioning the institutional developments. In the chapter, you mentioned primaries and caucuses. First of all, why don't we look at those? But then what else? Like, what are the other things that you see, the other institutional developments that
you can do Citizens United as an important case that powerfully asserted the sort of the power of corporations and obscene amounts of money in our electoral system. You can talk about the rash of new restrictive voting laws and real aggressive attempts on the part of the Republicans to restrict access to the ballot by traditional Democratic constituencies, especially racial minorities. You talk about extreme gerrymandering, which has come pretty close to eliminating meaningful electoral competition in many House districts. That may have started to shift in the midterms, but I would still say that's a really significant issue. Why we have partisan legislatures redrawing district boundaries and think of that as somehow democratic eludes me. And then there's caucuses and primaries, if you want to talk about those. But there's lots and lots of things that have happened over the last two or three decades that have really rendered our democracy much more fragile.
And the other thing you said in the chapter was about racial geography.
That's, again, where this sort of brand of Republican politics comes from. Remember, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln. They were a social movement party, actually. The electoral sort of wing of the abolition, the anti-slavery movement. And for, you know, until the mid to late 60s, Republicans were arguably more liberal on racial matters, civil rights matters. Now, in point of fact, both parties essentially organized sort of concern for civil rights out of their sort of policy agendas until, I would argue, at least the mid to late 30s, and especially after the World War II. We were in the Cold War context. But then Republicans really are quite a bit more liberal in their pursuit of civil rights reforms than Democrats were. That changed, though, when Johnson really quite aggressively and courageously, I would argue, under a lot of pressure, of course, effective pressure of the civil rights movement, came out four square for the major legislative victories of the civil rights movement in the early to mid-60s. And so angered by Johnson's betrayal, the white South essentially got over their historical hatred of the Republican Party, held their collective noses, and voted for Goldwater in 1964, which began to set the two parties on opposite courses, the opposite course they'd been on with respect to civil rights and indeed other policies as well. So it's that shift in the racial geography of American politics that really creates this context for the development of a kind of racially inflected party politics by the Republican Party. And you've got to slot Trump, even his more extreme version of this, into that 50-year history of racial politics, kind of exclusionary racial politics in the Republican Party.
And probably aided, and we'll bring Dave Karff into this, by the technology, which has also aided the resistance. So, Dave Karff, how do you see this?
The first thing I would add into the mix is what I think makes the resistance distinct from most of the social movements we're used to. Most social movements that will come to mind are concerned with setting the public and political agenda. You know, Black Lives Matter is trying to start a national conversation and then convert that into action. And the agenda setting function of the resistance is actually taken up by Donald Trump. The thing that brings the resistance together, and here I'd say it's quite a bit like the Tea Party that was also a resistance to Obama and whatever Obama was pursuing. Resistance activists, when they are getting started, aren't voicing a preference for let's not put kids in cages. And then when Trump puts kids in cages, the resistance says, okay, we are opposed to that. And that makes sense, and that's certainly aided by technology. We see this coming up actually, God, during the early Bush administration, the anti-Iraq war mobilization. We saw this sort of fast twitch digital politics come up through groups like MoveOn.org that were very good at allowing George W. Bush to set the agenda and then give activists and just motivated citizens who are watching aghast and want to do something an outlet. So rather than being issue specific, they are there as a response. Now, one thing that isn't in the book because it happened after the book is it seems to me that we're now seeing a bit of a change in that agenda setting function now that the Democrats have power, or at least some power, right? So the conversation amongst Democrats now is about things like the Green New Deal, which I think would have been hard to generate a conversation about during the first year and a half, 2 years of the Trump administration, because the focus, again, the agenda was being set by Trump. Now that we have divided government, there's still an awful lot of Trump response, but we see the sets of organizations that have collectively helped to make up the resistance movement focus in on more and more policy and both pressure Trump, but also start looking towards Democratic contenders for the next election.
Yeah, arguably, you could say that the Democratic majority was sort of aided by both the technology and also Trump. And it did produce people like AOC, which, you know, as we were talking earlier, Occupy failed to produce this kind of leader who could actually win a seat and put themselves into the halls of power. But you also talked about different resistance arms and how they were effective. You talked about something called indivisible, something called sleeping giants. Tell us about these and their various levels of success and how it all ties together.
So these are various digitally enabled organizational forms, each of which have been pursuing different goals, but quite effective. So to take it indivisible, that is what I would term in my pre-Trump work a neo-federated organization, where they noticed this upwelling of activist energy against Trump and said, okay, let's provide people with an outlet, and then let's craft that into an organizational form. So they have thousands of local groups around the country who joined Indivisible, and then the national organization helped those groups to find productive movement activities that could help resist Trump. Things like the healthcare town halls weren't just Indivisible, but Indivisible was a very prominent part of it. And that's different from a lot of the organizations that we saw in the digital politics of a decade ago, where most of the political associations that were forming online were one central staff core with a massive email list that they could email and say, okay, let's all do this together. And Indivisible also has a large email list, but is primarily asking people to meet with each other in groups and then craft local actions together in their own local spaces. Sleeping Giants is then an entirely different but also effective model, where Sleeping Giants was looking at Breitbart and its role both in setting the governing direction of the country and also in promoting the alt-right and white nationalism, and said, okay, we've got to fight against them. And the way that they found to fight against them was purely online, that they noticed, because the people who started it were advertising professionals, that there were all these programmatic ads that were running on Breitbart.com. It wasn't like a television program where the advertiser said, yes, we'd like to be on Breitbart. They had just said, okay, we want to advertise on the web, follow people around, and that meant that money was going to Breitbart. And so they would take screenshots and they would reach out on Twitter and say to various companies, hey, your ads are on Breitbart. Do you want to support this? If not, here's the simple way to fix it. And that led to hundreds upon hundreds of companies denying Breitbart revenue. Now, Breitbart is still here today, but they are poorer than they were before. They've had a bunch of leadership change because of the way that sponsor boycott was so powerfully deployed online.
It's now being done towards Fox, I understand. A similar kind of movement.
Well, and there's a history with Fox dating back to Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck one of the most popular entertainers on Fox. That he had, 3 million viewers per day. Tremendously influential and also spreading garbage conspiracy theories. And that led a collection of organizations, primarily Color of Change and Media Matters, to identify the advertisers that were advertising on Breitbart, on Glenn Beck, and reach out to them in a sponsor boycott and say, look, you're advertising on this. Here's what he said today. Here's how you can not pull your advertising from all of Fox, but from Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck got to the point where the only advertisements were for survival seeds and for their Fox shows. And not surprisingly, he then has to go off and start the blaze instead, which never quite worked the way he intended it to.
It seems, though, targeting individuals like Glenn Beck, just another one fills the shoes. Because of the model, right? Because of the economic model of media. As long as it's about making money, they'll find another person who will fan the flames to make more money.
So on the broad scale, yes. But I would also really put in a pitch here for one of the byproducts of activism being enforcing norms amongst elites. I don't think it's actually the case that when you get rid of Glenn Beck, another Glenn Beck immediately emerges. Someone does fill that time slot, but the person who fills that time slot and their entire editorial team says, well, no matter how popular you are, there's a line that if you cross it, you can get chased off the air. So let's dance more lightly around that line. That doesn't mean that Tucker Carlson today doesn't look a fair amount like Glenn Beck, but where Glenn Beck had a chalkboard full of conspiracy theories, Tucker Carlson is now trafficking in a quieter form of racism. And while that's still racism, there is at least something to be said for a quieter form. That is signaling to them that there's at least some behaviors that are out of bounds. If anything is, I think, the theme of the Trump years, it's that in a variety of elite politics, we no longer have any signaling that something is out of bounds. And so I'd say when activism chases a Glenn Beck off the air or really harms Breitbart, and that signals to the next Glenn Beck, the next Breitbart, that you got to at least be a little more subtle about it, that's still a powerful impact.
The other couple of things that I just wanted to ask you about, one was you talked about algorithms and how much they mattered. How did they matter here?
Well, so I think the key, there's a lot of ways that algorithms end up mattering today, again, that have changed.
In the movement, right? In the movement. And also with, obviously, you called him the chief clickbaiter or something like this. Obviously, clickbait makes algorithms function in a particular way. So, but it sounded like you were saying it also helped the movement in some way.
Yeah. So it's actually, I think, a little less about algorithms than about analytics and digital listening. So what we see is in this Trump era where activist organizations, both because Trump is such a different target than we're used to, and because the media environment is changing so fast, they've got to be experimenting with new tactics and new strategies. And they can use analytics, sometimes, you know, what Facebook gives them, what Google gives them, but more and more for these advocacy organizations, for Sleeping Giants, MoveOn, Indivisible, the internal analytics that they can farm, taking a look at which of their members are responding to what and running little experiments to find out if we change our tactics in this way, how does that change response rates? What are people willing to do? So it's the digital listening that comes through analytics that I think is most powerful. And what they end up doing with that is that there's an example I give in the book. MoveOn launched this project called MoveOn Video Lab. And there, what they did is when they saw Facebook Live being created, and Facebook was signaling that algorithmically, they're going to start giving preference in the newsfeed to grainy vertical footage. MoveOn said, okay, if that is what is now going to go viral on Facebook and Facebook is sending that message, let's set up a shop that can produce that sort of video so that we can reach larger audiences. So that's a story of algorithms, but more it's a story of Facebook, that rather than building your own Facebook, rather than building your own technology, since we're in an era of these giant tech platforms, you pay attention to what they're algorithmically rewarding, and then that becomes a real opportunity for activists to innovate new tactics.
When we come back,
the resistance to Donald Trump's America.
Stay tuned.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Joining us for the hour are four experts to talk about the resistance to Donald Trump's America. Joining us is David Meyer, University of California at Irvine, Doug McAdam from Stanford University, Kenneth Roberts from Cornell University, and David Karf at George Washington University. Well, let's turn to this sort of comparative and bring in Kenneth now. Kenneth Roberts, your point was that the U.S. is not alone in this. I imagine part of that is because of social media. Obviously, it was social media that brought the right wing to such extremes to New Zealand. So you called it something like competitive movementization. So help us put this into the international context.
Well, I think we see similar types of patterns that are underway in a number of other countries around the world. And in part, what you see in a place like New Zealand, you're seeing, I mean, certainly New Zealand is probably one of the last places where we would expect to see that, and certainly a country that has not known this kind of violence before. But in some ways, you see actors there feeding off of some of the international influences. And so you get patterns of political influence, a diffusion of certain kinds of extreme ideologies that will spread from one place to another. So there are elements of that that you see taking place. But I also think you see certain kinds of homegrown movements that are different expressions of white ethno-nationalism or far-right kinds of politics that are in particular mobilizing against immigration pressures or against certain patterns of economic globalization or the political integration of the European Union. So we're seeing a politicization of nationalist sentiments and national identities, and in particular white ethno-nationalist kinds of identities in a number of different places around the world now. And so certainly the media helped to propagate that and to diffuse it from one place to another. But in many respects, I think it's feeding off of very local and homegrown kinds of political tensions that exist in different places.
You also said that the United States is unique, partly because, you know, you saw the extreme actually going all the way to the top of the leadership and being mainstreamed. Can you help us understand that, maybe even why it happens that way in the United States, whereas it didn't really happen somewhere else?
Well, I think in particular, I was comparing the U.S. case to Western Europe, because in Western Europe, we see some of these far-right parties, what many people call populist parties of the right, but you see them emerging typically on the margins of traditional party systems. And so they carve out a niche in parliamentary systems, in particular where you have proportional representation elections. And so a party can emerge as a new kind of an outsider type of political party using proportional representation to gain at least some sort of access to parliament. And so you may have only a handful of seats. And even in places where they have gotten larger and stronger over the years, in a country like France, for example, where the National Front has been a major political contender for a number of years now, but they've not been able to compete. They've not been able to compete and take power at the national level or take executive office by winning a majority in the parliament. But there are a number of West European countries where they have been able to enter into electoral or political coalitions with more mainstream conservative parties and have at least some access to political power in that way. So we see versions of that in Austria and Italy. And then, of course, in a number of East European countries, you see parties of the nationalist right coming to power more directly. And so countries like Hungary and Poland in particular. So you see a range of different experiences. But I think part of what makes the U.S. different, and in part this reflects our own institutions and not having proportional representation, but in our electoral system, it's extremely difficult for third parties to get a foothold in the political mm-hmm. system. But what you see is that these nationalist and far-right kinds of tendencies work their way into the mainstream political parties, into the Republican Party. And essentially what you get, I would argue, is sort of a welling up of those pressures from the grassroots within the Republican Party, and then using Donald Trump as a vehicle, essentially as an outsider type of candidate, but within the traditional Republican Party. So Trump is certainly not a traditional Republican or part of the traditional political establishment. In some ways, he offered himself as a political outsider, but the logic of the American system was that got channeled into one of the traditional political parties.
So the other thing you said in that chapter was, in some of these, obviously, that went authoritarian, the authoritarian leaders moved to change the system so that they could criminalize opposition. And there are many right. ways that they could do that. Do you see that possibly happening here? Is there a masked effort? Is it possible?
I think one of the things that's striking and worrisome about some of the patterns you see overseas is, you know, the kinds of weakening of the erosion of democracy that you see in places like Eastern Europe. For the most part, these are not the traditional kinds of democratic breakdowns that take place by means of a military coup or an armed rebellion. Instead, what we're seeing are actors who use democratic institutions. So they run, you know, they organize political parties, they run for office in elections, they take power through democratic means, but then they use the institutional levers of a democratic regime to whittle away at democratic norms and practices themselves. And we see this in places in Latin America, you see it in places in Eastern Europe. And I think cracking down on political dissent or opposition becomes part of that. And I think we're, you know, we're a ways from that in the United States, but certainly I think in a context where the kinds of extreme partisan polarization that we see, and something that Doug McAdam talked about very effectively in his chapter, I think what you see with that is the strong negative partisanship that you see in the United States. So the Democrats and Republicans don't only identify with their own party, but they have intense antipathies for the other side. And so you see efforts not necessarily to criminalize dissent, but efforts to close up the political arena or to make it more and more difficult for the opposition party to gain access to certain kinds of institutions. And so the ways in which you tilt the democratic playing field or you skew the game in ways to make it more difficult for the other side to compete, I think those are the kinds of things that we tend to be worried about. And I think it's, you know, something to keep an eye on in the U.S. going forward.
Well, let's bring Doug McAdam in because he did suggest, was that you coming in or was I jumping the gun on somebody
else? I'm
happy to come in. So you did say that this is very fragile and fragmented, and it sounded like you were kind of concerned about the potential harms that could occur.
I think that's fair, although I think Kenneth is absolutely right that, you know, relative to, say, Poland, Hungary, other countries that he mentioned as well, we certainly aren't at the place they are, and their traditions, institutional traditions and procedures are not as well established as they have been in the U.S. But if you compare to other countries that have shifted dramatically to the right elsewhere in the world, the U.S. might look comparatively good. If the comparison is between the U.S. in 2019 versus the U.S. in, you know, 1960 or 1948 or something, I think there is clear cause for worry. A number of the institutional developments that we've been talking about really have had the effect of eroding democratic norms and processes and further polarizing, you know, the country. So I think that it's reasonable to see what's happening as the kind of ultimate stress test of American democratic institutions. And, you know, there's reason to be somewhat encouraged. Free press continues to do its work despite being, you know, villainized by Trump and his allies and so forth. Courts are continue to play largely an independent role, although one can be worried about the latest Supreme Court nomination and what that has done to the balance on the court and so forth. But in general, I think the institutions are holding up reasonably well. But again, if your comparison is with the U.S. in an earlier time period, most earlier time periods, at least in the 20th century, I would say, forward, then there is cause for concern. I would like to talk just briefly about primaries and caucuses. I guess the easiest way to say it is if the form of the system by which we nominate presidential candidates, that one that was in place in 1968, if it had been in place in 2016, Donald Trump would never have been the candidate of the Republican Party. In 68, you'll remember the Democrats nominated Hubert Humphrey, even though he hadn't competed in primaries. Primaries at that time were few and far between, and they were non-binding. So the only guy who competed in all the primaries was Eugene McCarthy. But the party establishment did not want Eugene McCarthy as the party's nominee, and so they turned to Hubert Humphrey. People remember the violence in the streets in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention, and they say that was about the war. In broad relief, that's probably right, but a lot of it was anger at what was happening inside the convention, where Humphrey was being anointed as the nominee, despite the fact that he hadn't competed in primaries. Ultimately, that did lead to pressure to change our system by which we nominate candidates in both major parties, and that certainly has wound up being a more democratic process than the one that prevailed in 68, but it's having, ironically, non-democratic consequences, because basically primaries and especially caucuses, which are on the rise, are very small turnout elections. And those small turnout elections have really played to the, I mean, are the perfect vehicle for the mobilized movement wings of the two parties. So I would argue that at the beginning of the primary process or the nominating process, in broad relief, the party did not want Donald Trump. But again, the nature of our primary and caucus system is the perfect vehicle for magnifying the influence of the ideological wings of the two parties. And so, you know, we were always assured that the median voter theorem in the U.S., the natural law of American politics, favored moderate centrists. But if a moderate centrist can't come through the primary process, and the process is geared to selecting a more extreme candidate, then that the supposed moderating effect of the American electoral system is not working to produce that more moderate sort of outcome.
David Meyer?
I think Doug is certainly right about that. I wanted to go back to the attacks on democratic institutions. I think everyone has said, to some extent, Trump and his supporters have made flurries to try to break down democratic institutions and democratic norms. And most of it's been an attack on norms, things that aren't laws, like we don't have regular press briefings, we don't answer questions, we don't talk to reporters who don't like us. None of that's laws, but there are also attacks on laws. On the Trump administration in the District of Columbia harshly prosecuted people who were present in the streets when there was a somewhat violent demonstration on the day Trump was inaugurated. And those prosecutions failed. They were dismissed with prejudice, but the lives of 236 people were held up and for over a year while the cases dragged on. The Census Department is trying to execute a census that asks questions that are deliberately designed to drive down the counting of minorities. And that's in the courts now, and we don't know how that's going to turn out. There's reckless disregard for the Emoluments Clause. There's more in the Senate, the Republican majority has abandoned norms that are longstanding, giving home state senators the opportunity to veto appointees for district courts in their own states. That's gone. The filibuster is all but gone, and Democratic candidates for office are now being asked to say whether or not they would do away with the filibuster altogether, which Donald Trump has already called for. Attacks on voting rights are now routine, and this is going to be another front in the battle for in 2020. And most of them aren't successful, but they keep trying. Libel laws. Candidate who was re-elected to Congress is now suing Twitter because of nasty things some accounts said about him. Up until at least today, nasty comments in the public arena about a candidate for office were part of the free speech protections of the Bill of Rights. Maybe that'll hold this time. But that's going to be tested over and over again as long as this moment continues.
Yes, I would just like to go back to some of these things as well, because you laid some of this out in the final chapter in terms of all of the efforts that various parts of the resistance had brought forward, including that court challenge to the Emoluments Clause and that sort of a thing. And I do see the appointments all across the courts as concerning, because it, you know, I mean, while judges have always been sort of part of a coalition, I don't know that we have seen the extremes that we're seeing today in terms of where in that coalition the judge is being drawn from. But yet at the same time, David, you had said in that you see a time when all of this might be in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, the problem with prediction is it's about the future. And I can imagine... a horrifying future in which democratic norms erode and we're just a couple of steps behind Poland and Hungary. And that's tragic. And I think that fear is mobilizing activists at the grassroots across the United States. But it's also possible to imagine a future in which people who realize that American institutions can be abused and that they actually do serve as guardrails for autocracy, for against fascism, develop a new respect for the integrity of those institutions. And it's an open question which way we go.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Four experts join us to talk about the resistance to Donald Trump's America. Joining us is David Meyer, University of California at Irvine, Doug McAdam from Stanford University, Kenneth Roberts from Cornell University, and David Karf at George Washington University. They're all contributors to The Resistance, The Dawn of the Anti-Trump Opposition Movement, the book we're discussing today.
Well, so I could either take this back to Kenneth Roberts for the comparative perspective, or we could look at the role of media in this, or we could look at the whole trajectory of American politics with Doug McAdam. So I'm going to let you guys decide who's next. Any volunteers?
Well, let me just say one thing, and then I would love to actually hear more from Kenneth on sort of how our sort of characterizations of what may or may not happen in the U.S., how that compares to other countries that he studied. Mm-hmm. But one thing I did want to say is I think the resistance, Dave characterized it very well at the outset. It is more amorphous. The speed with which it mobilized and mobilized new actors was quite extraordinary. At the moment, as we talk about this kind of stress test of American democratic institutions, most of the action is sort of centered within political institutions, Congress, the House, and under democratic control, courts, etc. And the resistance isn't playing, in my view, a particularly central role. But down the road, imagine that we really get to a point where we've reached a constitutional impasse. Some examples suggest themselves. The new attorney general, who has certainly not said for sure that he would release the Mueller report, decides he's not going to release the Mueller report. Or imagine that Trump is subpoenaed or is called upon to release various documents, tax returns, etc., and absolutely refuses, will not cooperate with any investigations and any court orders to do so. Imagine, fast forward to 2020 and the election, President Trump is defeated in that election, but as Michael Cohen sort of said in a worried way when he was testifying, that he doesn't, he could imagine Trump not going quietly, sort of resisting the will of the people, actually in an electoral sense. Imagine a Mueller report getting released and including bombshell revelations on obstruction of justice, collusion, emoluments, et cetera, and the House starting impeachment proceedings, but the Senate ultimately not being willing to take up the issue or rejecting the clear-cut evidence of impeachable offenses. At that point, we may really come to a point where an active resistance would be critical in helping to resolve whatever constitutional impasse we may find ourselves in. That may sound extreme, but I think, as David said a few minutes ago, it's not at all clear where this is really headed. There are lots of individuals, Trump, his allies, and essentially the Republican Party, that is intent on holding on to power. And as a number of people have said, if they can't hold on to it democratically, a lot of them seem prepared to try to hold on to it non-democratically. If we get to that point, and we really are at that kind of constitutional impasse, then an active, sustained resistance might be the only thing that resolves the crisis.
And the question, of course, is if it's not from the institutions, then what can a resistance do? Does it turn into Occupy, which was kind of futile, again, staying on the lawns of power? where the real power is in the halls and in the institutions, in the, you know, on the bench, in the Congress, in the, I mean, there are a lot of other kind of resistances that I see coming from the states and the cities. And when I teach here the American politics class, I sort of liken that to historic efforts, even looking at the Fugitive Slave Act and how certain cities and states kind of resisted turning in fugitive slaves. So I suppose there are those types of resistance movements that are also institutional, but just not on that federal level.
I think that's right. I mean, the U.S. system is so decentralized that there are lots of venues, institutional venues, that are controlled by actors who are not sympathetic to Trump. So you can imagine all sorts of sort of lines of institutional resistance all over the country. But I would insist, if you really got to one of these constitutional impasses that I imagined, that in the streets, active, sustained resistance would become a much more important part of the overall sort of dynamic than it might appear right now. I mean, think about the movement that overthrew Milosevic or Marcos or Mubarak, or, you know, we never imagined ourselves in the U.S. being in that kind of a situation, but it's not inconceivable that we'll find ourselves very much at that kind of an impasse. And again, sustaining an active grassroots resistance in the streets might be the only way forward if we really have gotten ourselves to a point where there's this entrenched constitutional crisis.
So Kenneth Roberts, Doug mentioned that he wanted to hear from you on this sort of global perspective, comparative perspective. What insight might you give us from that?
I think part of what stands out for me in looking at other cases abroad is you come to see that there's nothing intrinsic about the checks and balances, the institutional checks and balances of a democratic regime themselves that guarantee you that those institutions will function in a democratic manner. It really depends on, you know, who gains access to those institutions. And it's quite easy, in fact, to repurpose institutional checks so that they become instruments of some sort of authoritarian project or a hegemonic project by a particular political party. And so I think sometimes in the United States, there is what I would argue is a rather naive faith that we're different, you know, that there's something exceptional about American democratic institutions that makes it impossible that we would see the kind of democratic backsliding or erosion that takes place in other places. What I see taking place now, I think it is quite impressive the way in which you see the institutions themselves standing up to try to defend themselves, and certainly the Democratic Party, to the extent that it has access to those institutions, trying to use them to investigate and to place constraints on the Trump administration. And then the way in which you see societal actors mobilizing both at the grassroots and on the streets, but then also mobilizing at the grassroots in the electoral arena, trying to use existing institutional levers to try to maintain the resiliency of the regime itself. I guess clearly those forms of institutional resiliency are quite formidable in the United States, and I think they put us in a different ballgame than places like Venezuela was in Latin America when Chavez arose, or places in Eastern Europe that have seen autocrats emerge in recent years. So I think we're in a different situation here, but I think we really do see countervailing powers at work in American society, some of which I would argue are, you know, pushing for the whittling down of democratic institutions, and others which are pushing not only to protect those institutions, but in some ways even to expand democratic rights and liberties by encouraging types of electoral reform that would actually make our institutions more inclusive and more responsive to popular demands. And so I think there's a real, you know, there's a real tension that exists in American society because of the fact that we have these countervailing forces at work in American politics.
Well, Dave Karff has been quiet for a very long time. Let's bring you back in. What would you add to this?
I feel like I want to add a note of pessimism. I will echo that these institutions are resilient, but also they rely on actors with some set of good faith in fair processes. And the U.S. system has a bunch of inequalities baked into it, including the structure of the Senate. I spent a little while when I was in grad school studying electoral system design. There are no other democracies that around the world that looked at the U.S. Senate and said, that's a good idea. Basic violation of one person, one vote, which ends up being a real problem for the resistance as a movement. I mean, the simple example is you had this pretty overwhelming blue wave in the House elections in 2018, and Republicans still did well in the Senate just by because of the vagaries of the Senate map, and because North Dakota gets the same number of representatives in the Senate as California does. This has led, I've noticed in movement politics, towards more focus on consumer activism, because the set of people who live in big cities and have a bunch of money to spend get advertised to a lot, but have relatively less political voice than people who live in the rural middle of the country who are pretty well set. So the political institutions are right now less responsive than a lot of economic institutions, which is weird when you look back at the design. But all of that, if we start thinking about a post-Trump moment, let's say that Trump does lose his election and does leave in an orderly fashion. This goes back to Doug McAdams' point about all of the problems that we still have to face. It's hard to imagine a Green New Deal passing, but it's easy to imagine a Green New Deal passing thanks to a massive social movement and then a partisan Supreme Court deciding that, no, actually, they're just going to knock it down. And the structural power of our institutional resilience says that, on the one hand, courts shouldn't do that, but also if they do, they're resilient enough that it's not like there's a movement that can stop us from having courts the next day, the next month. So within the context of responding to this Trump moment and then sort of imagining a future moving forward, there are still these big complex problems that the U.S. and movements have to solve. And institutional resilience also means that these institutions are not very responsive to these tough changing circumstances. So I remain pretty worried myself.
Well, we're just about out of time, but we could probably take a couple of final concluding remarks. And David Meyer, I feel like we should bring you in to sort of bring this full circle, given that you're the editor of the volume.
With Sid Tarrow, yes. Sid and I edited, and there are great chapters in there by people who aren't even on this podcast or
imagine
radio
that.
Podcast. Yeah, imagine that. You can't get them all. So I don't want to be a Pollyanna. I don't want to punch a hole in David Karp's pessimism and concern. I think all those pessimism, all the pessimism, all the concern, all the anxiety is well justified. We don't want to wish this away. That said, there are signs about which we can be very optimistic. And any of us who are on a college campus has probably seen it. The movements, including a Day Without Immigrants, including the Women's March, including the March for Truth, the March for Science, including the Green New Deal, have spurred up a wave of youth activism, which is really exciting for people who want to have faith in democracy. There are young people getting engaged in the political process based on one issue, like the Parkland kids, and suddenly making contact with other kids who have different issues and finding a political power and collective voice. And I have enough of a religious commitment to participation that I really believe when these young people get involved, even if there are going to be mistakes and stupid statements and unpleasant tactics, sometimes, ultimately, American democracy gets stronger. Where I live, Orange County, is the heart of conservative electoral politics in the United States, or it was. It was represented by four Republicans in what were thought to be, three of them were thought to be safe districts, with a 70% voter turnout rate in the midterm elections, which is unheard of in the United States. I know, we're in the United States. All four of them flipped to Democrats. And those kids who made the difference by pushing up voter turnout, they're not likely to go away. The pessimistic side of me says, but the white racists who have also mobilized in response to Trump's call, they're not going to go away either. So we're in the middle of what may be a massive change in American politics.
And the one movement we didn't really touch on, which is something that Adam Winkler wrote about in his book, We the Corporations, is the movement to essentially usurp power from so many places by using the civil rights movement's tactics. And there is that too to contend with, I think, simultaneous to all of these issues around personal equality is the issue of corporate power. You know, that's certainly not going away anytime soon.
That's right. And you have specific policies that are being advanced on a daily basis. Elizabeth Warren, who doesn't look like she has the biggest popular following in the Democratic Party, has the most comprehensive policy proposals that are going to be on the shelf, in the drawer, ready to go, no matter what Democrat gets elected, if a Democrat gets elected and can take office. And that moves the debate forward.
Well, I'd like to thank all four of you for joining us today on the Scholar Circle, a really important book and a really important conversation. David Meyer, Kenneth Roberts, Doug McAdam, Dave Karp, thank you so much for joining us, sharing your wisdom and your research on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Doug McAdam is a professor of sociology at Stanford University and a former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. His 18 books include the prize-winning Freedom Summer and Deeply Divided: Racial Politics and Social Movements in Post-War America. Kenneth Roberts is a professor of comparative and Latin American politics at Cornell University. He's the author of Deepening Democracy, The Modern Left and Social Movements in Chile and Peru, and the co-author of The Resurgence of the Latin American Left. David Meyer is professor of political science and sociology at the University of California at Irvine. He's the author of The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America, and he's co-editor with Sidney Taro of The Resistance, The Dawn of the Anti-Trump Opposition Movement. David Karp is associate professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Move-On Effect: The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy and Analytic Activism, Digital Listening, and the New Political Strategy. They're all contributors to The Resistance, The Dawn of the Anti-Trump Opposition Movement, the book we're discussing today. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.